Hi everyone, my name is Jean-Marie from Jonathan Ball, and we are at the Kingsmead Book Fair today, and I have the amazing pleasure of sitting with four authors next to me. And before I try and, now I'm not going to say pronounce because I can't pronounce all of your names, I can, but I'm going to ask you to all introduce yourselves, if you will, and just also mention your latest book, that you are representing at the festival.
My name's Tony Park. I am Australian originally, but my wife Nicola and I live pretty much full time in South Africa. We first came here in 1995 for a holiday, got hooked, and I started writing books around about the same time. So I've written 22 thriller novels, all set in Southern Africa, with a common theme of the endangered trade, the trade and endangered wildlife. My latest book is called The Protector, and it's about the trade in endangered pangolins.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I'm Juliet Mweta, originally from Cape Town, but at the moment we're living in between Nice and Hanky. Well, when I say we, it's my husband and I. Then my latest or my first book that's out now at the moment is If the Dead Could Talk, and it's meant to be a whodunit, Agatha Christie style.
Awesome.
My name is Costa Ayotis. I'm an Egyptian-born Greek South African. This is my latest book is called Matriarchs, Meze, and the Evil Eye, and it's a prequel to My Big Fat Greek Taverna. Both of them are memoirs.
And my name's Marina Auer. I'm a South African-born South African, and I write medical thrillers. I'm here representing Single Minded, but I have a new book that is coming out in the next few weeks, and so that's really what's on my mind.
Okay, that's very exciting. So how have you guys found the festival so far?
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I've been to Kingsmead a couple of times in the past. The last time, I don't know if it was snowing, but I think it was sleeting, maybe. So it's nice to have good weather here. And the thing I like about Kingsmead is, of course, we come for the books and the authors, but there's also a wonderful community vibe about this festival. It's like a fun festival.
Yeah, I would say so too. Especially, this was my first time at Kingsmead. I hadn't even been before as an author. It's my first Kingsmead festival and my first time just being here. And what Tony's saying, that vibe of between the authors, that green room, I was like, wow. And then also had a bit of a groupie effect as I saw authors I knew, and like, I want to touch that one. I want to touch that one. And I'm never taking off this top again or this blouse because they hugged me. I rather enjoyed
That's awesome.
This is my second Kingsmead. And I think it's because it's a one-day event, a lot happening. The grounds are magnificent, the vibe, the food, so much happening. I mean, the other festivals, I mean, NASA, France, are also fantastic, but they're over 3 days. So this is really Joburg energy, and it happens. And as you said, the green room, meeting other authors that I used to read about these people and wonder, before you get published. So it's really a very special day.
Yeah, for me, it's my second time at Kingsmead, and I definitely look forward to coming back. Last year, my first experience of it, I very much stayed in the green room and in my venue and didn't wander out much, just finding my feet. And so I'm feeling a lot more comfortable this year. It's a great fire.
And isn't it really cool that it's in a school? You know, and you see the young women in the school and they're engaged. And in an ideal world, like if every school should have something, maybe not this big, but some event that celebrates readers and just gets kids really involved in the whole process.
So I actually have suggested it to my the librarian at my daughter's school. I actually wanted them to come up and experience this because I think her my daughter's school back in Durban would be a great place to do something
And it
similar.
Doesn't have to be huge, because
Doesn't
us authors will go to anything.
And I think it's really fascinating how they involve the kids in terms of taking the authors around, because I think it also exposes them, you know. Maybe someone was thinking of being a writer, or and now they can see, wow, okay, I can actually speak to an author, or they are exposed to this, you know, which is also
Absolutely.
amazing. Okay, I'm going to jump in with a question. If you can all please answer this, what was the first story you wrote, and would you ever share it with the world now?
So when I was a little kid, I wrote some stories, which I shouldn't be sharing with the world, I think, but they were fun. I liked doing it. I wrote a manuscript before I was published, my first full manuscript, and I learned a lot from it. And I'm one of the writers that doesn't plot. I just make stuff as I go along. But I had to learn that because the first manuscript I wrote, which was set in Australia in the outback, Costa and I were talking about Darwin and Northern Australia before, which is a really diverse, interesting part of Australia. So I wrote a novel set in the Second World War in the Northern Territory of Australia, but I hadn't actually been there at the time. But I read a couple of books about how to write and they said, you have to plot. You have to have everything organized before you start, beginning, middle, and end, know who your characters are. And I thought, okay, that's the way to write a book. So that first manuscript I wrote like that, and I didn't enjoy it. I was like, on one hand, I was living my dream. My wife let me quit work to write a manuscript. But here I was, it was like trying to manufacture something using a blueprint. And I found it really difficult. And that book, I would probably not show it to anyone because it was terrible. But I learned from that 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 was not the way I wanted to write. So the next novel I wrote, which was set in Southern Africa and got published, I just made up as I went along, wrote by the seat of the pants. And I really enjoyed that. So I think when you're writing, if you have a couple of failed attempts or missed false starts, it doesn't matter because you're learning all the time. But the key for me that I took away from that is I had to enjoy it. I had to find a process that I could enjoy. Wow.
Yeah. This is the first manuscript I've sent in to a publisher. This one, but beforehand I wrote stories I really thought these should be bestsellers. I remember my very first one, I think I was like 16 or 17, but it was some Victorian story. you know, it's so funny because I'm a Xhosa girl and this Victorian story of set in England with all these different people who aren't my race riding, you know, when you're watching Jane Austen and she meets her prince and all of that sort of fairy tale, like very different to what I've written now. So that story, if I ever found it somewhere, I would never, ever show it to the world. Yeah.
I think, yeah, the story, as Tony says, stories, I mean, it starts with creative writing at school. And I think some of those essays, I mean, we wrote a lot of essays, we're lucky at school. And I would write these war stories about World War II because I was obsessed, you know, my generation, all those movies about World War II.
You should write them as books now. Justin Fox is doing really well with his World War II books.
I greatly what he does, taking sort of fiction, taking nonfiction thread and then touching on with fictional characters. He does a great job. And I think it starts there at school, the creative writing, and I would never submit those. But this book, Matrox and the Evil Eye, this was an early manuscript that was a huge 600-pager overwritten and a baggy meandering, and then suddenly Random House wanted it and Penguin looked at it, and then it didn't happen. And Michelle Magwood gave it the time. And then eventually sort of dusted it off the shelf, and it came as it was supposed to be the first book, and it became the prequel to the first book.
Did they cut it down for you, or did you do some real work on it?
I did a lot of work, but they also said, listen, you've got to delete, you've got to cut. Yeah. A lot of stuff has to go into the spare parts bin.
600 pages.
Yeah, stuff on Egypt's got to be a completely different book. And that was good advice.
Good, yeah.
But I think to your point, Tony, also take imperfect action.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the early stuff, you know, you trying too hard to impress and to show how clever you are. And if you just relax, breathe.
And don't throw it away. I'm not going to throw away that first manuscript because if I get desperate in a few years, that's coming back. It's not that bad.
But nothing goes wasted. All of that stuff, you know. So it's just get something on the page and fix it as you go along. So people, this thing about writer's block and getting stuck, just put something down. You fix it with great editors and you recycle it somehow.
Good advice.
Okay. My experience quite similar to Tony's in that I was given some advice which wasn't great for me. Told that don't base a book in South Africa because an international market is not going to be interested in a South African story. So base your novel somewhere else. And so not knowing any better, I thought, well, I don't know anywhere else in the world. I'll just make up a fictional island and I'll base my novel there. And I just struggled the whole way through it with feeling a lack of authenticity. And getting close to the end of the 80,000 words is always my sort of happy rounding off point. Getting close to the end of it and thinking, this is not really something that can get published. This is not a great story. It might get there with a bit of tweaking, but am I okay with it going into the bottom drawer and living there? And the answer to me was I was okay with that. It could be my training wheels experience. Yeah. And so that's It's still there in the bottom drawer. I don't know if I have the energy to go back and try and fix it. I think I might cringe, like my daughter says she's going to cringe if she has to read my book. But I think I would cringe if I had to try and take it out and read it now. But it was such a great learning experience just to know that I actually could pencil all the way through pencil, just know that I could start on page one and get to page 300 or whatever it is. And get a story out on the page.
Yeah, because it's an achievement, bro. Yeah. Just to, and I always say that to people who are starting out, and I do a bit of mentoring for writers in Australia. Don't underestimate what you've done, even if it doesn't get published. You know, that is an achievement to finish a manuscript, and you'll learn from it even if it doesn't get published.
Yeah, yeah.
And so not to agonize over it too much either, because a lot of people will write a really, what I think is like a really well-written manuscript. They're almost too scared to send it to a publisher because they think it has to be perfect. I said, don't be like that, you know, because it couldn't just be, the publisher either wants that story or they don't. And if it needs work, they'll work on it. And then I say to people, start on something else because, you know, this might not be your first one. The first one might be your second one or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. And can I ask all of you, what inspired the setting and the plot of your most recent novels, and how important is place in your storytelling in all the different books?
Yeah. I'll jump in there because for single-minded, it's very much settings-based. Single-minded, the setting came to me first before the character did, which is not a great way to write, because if character comes first, then the character, their struggles can lead the narrative in the direction in which it needs to go. But the setting of Eden State Hospital was so clear to me because it is the hospital in which I did my internship and community service. So very real, very alive, and very easy to get on the page. And I enjoyed that process very much because it's a dark, dingy place. So bringing in those kind of gothic horror elements, dark passageways, locked doors that don't stay locked, all of the elements that lend a bit of intrigue to the story. I really enjoyed the setting of a dark and dingy hospital for single-minded. And I wish I could write every story in that kind of setting, but that's just not possible. So, yeah, my other books are a little bit more contemporary, more modern hospitals. But I loved working with Eden State Hospital.
And can I just quickly jump in while you're talking about the hospital specifically? Is the story rooted in your own experiences of working there?
Very much so. Apart from the sinister motive behind the bodies being found out in the fields around the hospital. But when I was internship comm service, it all kind of blurs now because it's a long time ago. But bodies were found in the grounds around Eden Dale Hospital, where I did my internship. And they probably were just patients who wandered out and never got thought of again.
Wow.
But that's part of the story with single-minded, is that they're these neglected souls that no one cares about. But very much based on my experiences there, rats in the beds and all.
Sure.
You
know?
Oh,
wow.
All right. Wow. Yeah. So I'm just listening as you're speaking about the setting of the hospital. Sounds very eerie and similar to what I would love to set my books in. But I've set mine in Nyasaland because, you know, as writers, we always get the advice, write what you know. And so I do live in Liza, and I do know the Liza township quite well, and I do know the urban area quite well as well. And then townships I'm familiar with, I know at the back of my hand, or not really as much as I would know Nyasaland, is the Port Elizabeth townships. So even though I was born and raised in Cape Town, I don't know the Capetonian townships, but I've set my stories in places that I can, that I do know, which made it a lot easier when I described them and the characters as well. It's from people I've seen around there, just changed their names a bit. So it felt more authentic. I remember that very first story of mine that I wrote, 16 and 17. I also kind of had to make the country up. Couldn't really set it in England because I've never been in England. I wanted to go, but it was all kind of that setting. But now since it is South African and very Xhosa as well, it felt more authentic and it came easier because I was talking about what I know. So that is where my setting is.
Okay.
I think for me, I was inspired by Graham Greene, that childhood is the credit balance of the writer. Mm. So I grew up in a home with three very formidable matriarchs. So it's very much specifically, it's a set. It goes from Egypt to South Africa in the 60s and 70s. Little boy sitting in a kitchen. And of course, my mother is still alive and has a formidable memory. So it's pretty much her book as it is mine, being a memoir and observing the dynamics, the conflict between these three women, almost farcical with a lot of humor, sharing a kitchen and sharing a home, a young mother, a mother-in-law, and a sister-in-law from hell, from my mother's point of view. So for me, very much set, perhaps maybe easier to write because remember those things from your childhood, the little boy sitting in the corner, and then, of course, listening to the grown-ups. You'd sit there and listening to mother and yaya and nona speak. And all those sort of marinated into me. And of course, with the food and the conflicts about food and the rivalries. So all those stories are in Matrox. So yeah, very much set in, again, as Juliet said, write about what you know. So that I lived that intimately and could maybe relate it on the page.
Yeah. I mean, setting and place are crucial, absolutely crucial for my books. And people say that's another character in the book. And I think it's very true because these are thrillers, wildlife thrillers set in the African bush. And they're set in the places that I like to visit near where I live. I live in a house on the edge of Kruger Park. So The Protector in the latest book starts off in Kruger and then it moves up through Kruger into Zimbabwe, ends up at Lake Kariba and Victoria Falls, because that's where I happened to be traveling when I was writing The Protector. So I write on location as I'm going. I'm published by Pan Macmillan in South Africa and Australia, and I self-published in the US and the UK. A large part of my market internationally outside of South Africa is South Africans and Zimbabweans who've moved away. For what they will tell you, ad nauseum, are very good reasons. And they are often quite quick to criticize their homelands, but there is not one of them who after a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or a beer doesn't say, oh, but I missed the bush. So yeah. I think a lot of people buy my books because of that. They had an affinity or have an affinity if they still live here now with the wildlife, with wild places, and they miss it, And the diaspora misses things like, oh, I remember the Shell Ultra City at Middleburg because I used to stop there on my way to the Kruger Park and I've been to that spur. So the place is very important for me.
Okay. And I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to focus on pangolins specifically?
Yeah, well, I was aware of the trade in pangolins generally, but they're a hard group of animals and conservationists to write about because they're very rarely seen in the wild. I've never actually seen one in the wild. And the pangolin researchers and conservationist people are like pangolins. They keep themselves tucked away. But I was lucky that one of my readers was a PhD student studying pangolins, and she put me in touch with her professor. And what I unearthed in my research was frankly horrifying. This is a trade that dwarfs the rhino trade, dwarfs most other illegal trade. 535,000 African pangolins killed for their scales in the last 8 years. Mm. And the professor I got to interview from Shwane University of Technology, in his spare time, happens to run an undercover anti-poaching unit in real life. And people say, where do you get your ideas for your book? So my lead character in The Protector happens to be a professor who runs an anti-poaching unit in her spare time.
Wow.
That's fascinating. I'm going to ask you to finish, if each of you can go and finish this sentence for me. That's going to be my last question to you today. When I'm not writing, you'll probably find me
Reading by the pool.
Oh, well, reading has been taken. But you probably would. But the second next best thing is playing FIFA. I'm a huge gamer. So that's okay. The second. But because he took writing.
I've had to find a different creative outlet. Outlet, yes. Thanks, Tony. So I cook. So my creativity then goes like, so I pull out the pans and the knives and start cooking.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Working, because working a real job.
Yeah.
Not that writing isn't a real job, but I do need an income. So, yeah, working in the hospital.
I'm kind of lucky that I write full time. It's my living. And if people say, don't you get tired of doing this and promoting and going to festivals? And I say, look, it beats working.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I hope you have a very good festival for the rest of the day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great meeting everyone.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.